Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, a conversation with a panel of activists and community leaders as we continue to reflect on the 2015 violence and uprising sparked by the death of Freddie Gray. Last year, the Department of Justice issued a report detailing widespread misconduct and unconstitutional practices within the Baltimore Police Department. The city signed a consent decree with the DOJ, and city leaders have vowed to reform the department. Will those reforms be enough to build trust between police and communities of color? 2 years after the uprising, are residents seeing any differences in their communities? Elder C.W. Harris is the pastor of Newborn Community of Faith, Ray Kelly is the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition, and Davon Love is the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. They join me on Midday, right after these headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm so glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall, and you're listening to Midday. It's been 2 years since violence sparked by the death of Freddie Gray coursed through Baltimore. Much has happened since that fateful week in April of 2015, and many have expressed frustration that so much remains to happen to address the root causes of the unrest. Immediately following what has come to be known as the uprising, there was a widespread agreement among politicians and community leaders that longstanding systemic racism and economic inequality were at the heart of the unrest. Six police officers were charged in connection with Freddie Gray's death. None were convicted. Last summer, the Justice Department issued a scathing report detailing widespread misconduct and unconstitutional practices by the Baltimore Police Department. The city signed a consent decree with the DOJ late last year, and Mayor Pugh and Police Commissioner Kevin Davis say that they're committed to widespread reform within the department. So last week and this week, we're reflecting on the death of Freddie Gray and what has happened in the 2 years since. Coming up on Wednesday here on Midday, Police Commissioner Davis will join me to talk about his efforts to reform the BPD. Last week, we spoke with Dr. Freeman Hrabowski of UMBC, Erica Alston Buck of the Kids Safe Zone in Sandtown, Sarah Heminger of Thread, and a panel of legal analysts who talked about the prospects of the consent decree to lead to fundamental change in policing in Baltimore. So today, we get the perspective of some community activists, all of whom have been prominent before and since the death of Freddie Gray. Elder C.W. Harris is the pastor of Newborn Community of Faith and the founder of Intersection of Change, that's formerly known as Newborn Holistic Ministries. They're a community-based nonprofit focused on community development in West Baltimore. Elder Harris, always
Certainly a pleasure, sir.
Seeing
you.
Mm-hmm. Good to have you back. And Ray Kelly is here again as well. He's the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition. That's a resident-led advocacy organization based in Central West Baltimore. Ray, always a pleasure as well to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
A little bit later, we'll be joined by Davon Love. He's the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. That's a grassroots think tank that focuses on public policy interests of Black people in Baltimore. You are welcome to join our discussion about what's taken place since the death of Freddie Gray and the unrest and uprising that followed. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at Midday, Tom Hall. So, Elder Harris, let me start with you. Right before the the primary election we had last spring, you actually literally went up on the roof of a building named after you and a guy who runs a wonderful community program in Sandtown named Todd Marcus. And you stayed up there until folks voted in the primary. And your point was to bring attention to the fact that political engagement was certainly a piece of what needed to happen if real change was going to take place in Sandtown Winchester, a community you've been part of for many, many years. Mm-hmm. What's happened since then? Do you have a sense that there is more intensified recognition of the political process and the potential of the political process? And do you think you're seeing more engagement by the community?
Yes, I do, because we started a civics 101. We're getting community residents involved in understanding of our city government. I also remind them of how important their vote was. And we like to feel that we were able to get our mayor into office because of our vote. And I express to them that now we need to hold her and others accountable because we have a voice. So we went from 250-some to us breaking the record of over 1,000 who voted in our community. And we're looking to increase it every year.
And, you know, much has been made of the fact that Saturday marked the 100th day of the Trump administration. So that means it's about 130 days or so for the Pew administration here in Baltimore. She took office, I believe, on the 6th of December, 2016. What kind of grade would you give her so far?
Well, she's still on her honeymoon. And we have not had much conversation with her lately. And so we are preparing for that day. And we are getting our, we are sharpening our swords. On sharpens on. And when that day comes, we will be right on target. And we are looking for answers. She did have a meeting at Trinity Baptist Church with our young people. And they did a marvelous job with her. And they did ask the questions, why did you cut our money out when you said you wasn't going to do it? And she had a
Which cut was she talking about? Was that the minimum wage bill?
It wasn't the minimum wage. It was in a direct response to helping the kids in school and in their education. And she had a lot of explaining to do. And so she explained herself. And so our officials are now realizing that they have to hold themselves accountable for the people that they serve. They just won't, we just won't let them just sleep on by and not answer to us because we did the nonviolent act of voting. And so that's very important.
Yeah. And Ray Kelly, I mean, you have been on the ground. You have been in direct contact with so many of the people. You know these folks intimately. You know their stories. You know their concerns, you know their lives. Do you think the political establishment in the city was, in fact, kind of sleeping on by, as Pastor Harris says? And has there been a change, do you think, in the energy level, in the determination, in the sort of mood of progress that the folks want to see happen in West Baltimore and other places?
So I think that we recognize that our whole effort was about community voice and actually empowering our community to kind of stand up and do for themselves. And that's kind of what was the catalyst to the whole effort to increase the voter turnout. So it wasn't just about the registering people to vote and getting to the polls. We wanted to actually not just have a voter presence, but a communal presence and be recognized as a community. So that whole voter turnout was following behind the efforts with the report that No Boundaries put out over policed and underserved, where we kind of looked to elevate the voice of people that were historically unheard. So the tripling the voter turnout in Sandtown, Winchester was just showing that our community wants to be engaged. Now, as far as progress, that's a whole different story, where throughout the progress, there's been continual community engagement to influence the actual reforms that came in the consent decree, and undisputedly our voices were heard. You can see recommendations made directly by residents of 21217 in Sandtown to the DOJ verbatim in the consent decree. But we now have the opportunity to actually do what we were talking about. So
you mentioned the consent decree as a palpable demonstration of some progress that has been made. And there was your report where you interviewed many, many residents of Sandtown. We should say, by the way, that both you and Elder Harris are lifelong residents of Sandtown. It's not
absolutely
like you came
correct.
not like you came to this game late. You know, and
6 or 7 years.
Yeah, God bless.
For him.
Yeah, for him. Yes. Mr. Kelly is quick to point out. But we've had your report. We had the Department of Justice report, which was really a scathing indictment of unconstitutional behavior by the police over a long, long period of time. We had then the consent decree that followed that report. Are there other things? Are there things in particular you can point to in these last 2 years since the death of Freddie Gray that have changed on the ground? I mean, there's a lot of looking forward to change. I'm just wondering, is there anything in 2 years' time that you could say, yeah, this happened?
Well, many things are happening that are empowering the community that aren't really getting a lot of momentum. Elder Harris just spoke about the meeting with the mayor and the Baltimore Youth Organizing Project, where during the primary season, they actually had a mayor's forum with all the candidates. And the unrest kind of afforded us to create this entity where we can actually have young people have a voice of advocacy in the same manner that No Boundaries does, and the way that New Song would, where they needed to be a visible and heard community advocacy effort. And that's been working out, where now we're in our second year of that youth organizing project, and we were able to hire 10 youth from our community and give them a small stipend.
Very good.
And they've been active in advocating for what they want. Like Elder Harris said, they are now holding the mayor accountable for cuts that she made to year-round jobs for youth and after-school funding that she committed to during the primary
during
season.
The campaign.
So
yeah.
Because of this continual engagement at every level, now we also have another group that's holding our elected officials accountable. Like I said, the progress is slow, but things are happening. We at No Boundaries have always had two prominent issues that we work on. It's the police and community relations issues that we've been working on for years, and we've also had a health initiative that addresses the food desert issue. So because our community had recognition because of the unrest and the actual state of our community was actually recognized, we did have the opportunity to bring attention to that, where now we have a fresh produce stand at the public market on Pennsylvania Avenue. And this is like another effort that's only in the thought process of people like us that are indigenous, because we now partner with Strength to Love, too, Elder Harris's urban farm. So now we've started the process of creating a paradigm where not only do we have access to healthy food in our community, but we have a conduit where we grow this food in 21217. Strength to Love, too, hires returning citizens to our community. So now we're addressing that issue, too, of finding viable employment for these returning citizens. Mm-hmm. And then we are selling his product in the same community. So we're trying to actually build a self-sustaining model for healthy food access in Baltimore.
Yeah,
and
Elder Harris,
and at a reasonable price.
Mm-hmm. And this is no small feat here. This is an extremely important thing. I mean, as Ray says, you've got the issue of food deserts. It's just really difficult for folks to find good food, healthy food that's easy to get to and to get into their kitchens.
So housing, we have education, And it's, we know the gamut. And our community has been neglected so long. But it takes dedicated people such as myself and Ray Kelly and others. We can name them all. And when you see people who are really concerned, see, I'm optimistic because I'm a slave to hope. And I just can't help myself. And it seemed to me that there should be enough humanitarians, people who are human, that see the plight of the poor, that would be able or want to be able to wash the feet of those of God despised few. So, yes, there are many things that are happening. We have Turnaround Tuesday on the west side now.
Mm-hmm. With Build, right?
We're with Build. And they started on the west side with Pastor Prentice. We begged and begged, and now they're on the west side. So we're getting folk jobs. You know, it's just one thing at a time, and that you become dedicated in whatever you do to make sure it come to fruition.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk about more of the initiatives and programs that you all have going on the west side and throughout the city. That's Elder C.W. Harris. He's the pastor of Newborn Community of Faith and a founder of Intersection of Change. Ray Kelly is the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition. We hope to be joined by Davon Love when we come back from a break. He's the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We're reflecting on the 2-year anniversary of the death of Freddie Gray. The violence and uprising that followed his funeral took place 2 years ago last Thursday. You can join us here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stay. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, it's our monthly feature, The Midday Culture Connection, with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. The author and columnist D. Watkins will join Sherry and me to offer his reflections on the 2 years since the uprising and other topics of note. And by the way, if you were one of those folks who joined us at the Parkway Theater on Friday, we're very grateful that you came out and got a sneak peek at the beautiful Parkway Theater, the new home of the Maryland Film Festival. Thanks for turning out and tuning in on Friday. Remember that the film festival begins on Wednesday. We do think that that will be a very transformative place for Station North and for our city. If you're just joining us today, my guests are Davon Love of the think tank Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Elder C.W. Harris of Intersection of Change in West Baltimore, and Ray Kelly, the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition. You are welcome to join us today, 410-662-8780, our email address, midday@wipr.org. And if you can follow us on Twitter, we're @MiddayTomHall. So, Davon, welcome. And let me ask you what I've asked Ray Kelly and Elder Harris. Do you see any palpable signs of progress, improvement, and forward motion since in these last 2 years, since the death of Freddie Gray and everything that happened immediately after?
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. I would say yes and no. And the reason why I say that is I think we're in a moment where what the uprising did was it brought front and center the issue of institutional racism and how it actually operates in our institutions. And I think people were more willing to talk publicly about, you know, the nature of institutional racism in a way that wasn't the case before the uprising. A part of what has happened, though, is that there are a lot of individuals and organizations that have tried to incorporate the vocabulary and vernacular of institutional racism and white supremacy and how it operates in ways that leave intact the same institutions that have had the power over the past several years that have created a situation that we're in. And so when we think about, we give a few examples, when you think about, for instance, the Greater Baltimore Committee, right? Very powerful institution in Baltimore City. You know, and after the uprising, there was interest in, you know, a lot of different efforts, you know, around reentry and police reform. You know, they would, you know, have those conversations. But what people weren't willing to put forward in the way necessary is to say, well, that institution is part of the problem, right? Because a part of what has happened is that the corporate sector has often been the entity or the group of entities that folks have felt like they've had to capitulate to, right? And that's been part of the problem, where the community is often seen as an afterthought. So again, while and there's some folks that have developed a platform, you know, after the uprising that I think has allowed these critiques to be more available to the masses. You know, so, you know, Elder Harris and Ray Kelly, who were certainly doing work before the uprising, you know, now, you know, have platform, and myself, you know, have platforms to be able to, you know, to have these conversations. But again, I think we probably would all agree that, you know, in terms of leadership of major institutions with resources to make major decisions, there's still a fight to really change that dynamic.
And Ray Kelly, how does that dynamic then change? Because on the one hand, you've got a philanthropic community that's in this town still largely white run, certainly, but willing at various levels and with various degrees of commitment to be involved and to help. You've got resources from places like the Annie E. Casey Foundation and the and other large donors, you know, the Open Society Institute. They raised something like $800,000 since the uprising. Annie E. Casey gave $300,000, as far as I know, to an effort called One Baltimore, which ended up kind of fizzling after a while. But, you know, they were trying, and we can talk about why that fizzled and the dynamics of that. But has these communities that have been marginalized, the places, the folks you've been working with for years and years and years, if they have been given more of a place at the table, what's that resulting in? Is it you know, is there going to be more cooperation between outside groups helping? And is that a good thing?
So I'll say two things happened definitely in the past 2 years is the people that are committed to actual change have been identified. They are the people that have been in those meetings between events, so to speak. So the actual stakeholders and those vested in changing this whole systemic structure are identified. And as far as funders, there has to be an ethical approach to how we kind of create this change. And there is, for lack of a better term, a lot of paper chasing happening in the community where people who aren't really invested in the process, like Davon spoke of, the community is an afterthought. Those are the things that make it contentious. No Boundaries Coalition is grant funded, but we choose what we apply for, and our process is always to build upon what we've been doing. So there, we have limited stipulations because of our structure, but there is an influx of programming and initiatives coming into the community that are really more triage efforts and not really solution-based. They're more addressing a problem and putting Band-Aids on it, so to speak. So we have to kind of push for grassroots changes and not just opportunities.
And Elder Harris, I hear this from a lot of folks who say, okay, we got these funders coming in. Again, these are folks from not from the community. They are white-run organizations by and large. And there's all these metrics and things that have to be proven that you accomplished, and the number of people served and all that kind of stuff. And that there is a disconnect between what these foundations want to give money to and what is really needed on the ground. Now, Intersection Change is now 20 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been at this for two decades. Mm-hmm. You've got an arts program, Jubilee Arts. You've got Strength to Love, which we talked about in the first segment. It's
Martha's Place.
You've got Martha's Place dealing with
Strength to Love too.
You know, people dealing with addiction and stuff. So you're doing the actual work. Is there still this disconnect between what you have to admit are well-meaning folks, well-meaning people who want to say, you know, we want things to change, but maybe they want it to change in their vision of it instead of the vision of the people who actually live in Sandtown, Winchester?
Well, T. Rowe Price gave us carte blanche. When I said us, I'm talking about Strength of Love, too, and No Boundaries. We just received $150,000 from Casa Permanente. They give us carte blanche. We have these folks who we receive credits from now because we're proven. That's what it takes. We were doing this long before they were giving us money. We were making serving bread sandwiches and making that a meal. And the folks who are with us and working with us, they believed in us. And that's where it started. We made chicken soup out of chicken feathers, brother.
And is this a matter of credibility, do you think? I mean, did it take some of these funders a while to just sort of figure out, okay, well, they got a 20-year track record. They must be doing something right.
We have cred. Mm-hmm. We have cred. I mean, I think the three of us here, we are staples in our community, and folk know us, and we spread ourselves around. I was at the White House and received the Presidential Medal of Honor, and Saturday I received honor from Greater Baltimore Urban League. So all of these things, and I'm just saying this, but each one of us received those things. Funders see that, they hear about us, and they want to support us. And our track record and our records are pure. Let me say this. The drug situation in our communities, it's a long story. The war is just crazy. It is a health issue. And we can better police the police if we get rid of this situation and stop fooling ourselves with this drug fight. It is a public health issue. It need to be out of the hands of law enforcement into the hands.
Yeah, and Davon Love, the Trump administration would say, no, it's not. It's a law enforcement issue. It seems like there's been a giant step back to an approach to the drug problem in particular that is, you know, redolent of Clinton era, three strikes and you're out, and high rates of incarceration. I mean, Jeff Sessions has shown no indication that he's read any of the most recent data.
Yeah, so a couple things. Something that we actually just talked about a second ago. I think it's really important for people to understand that oftentimes what happens in our community is that exceptional people get lifted up and are able to get access, right? And I think what oftentimes happens in terms of funders is that you're right. They will, you know, fund, you know, those of us in this room and others to be able to help with certain projects and maybe support some of the stuff we're doing. But oftentimes what happens is there's a larger ecosystem of folks in our community, our neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. They don't get access to those resources or the platform necessary. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think it's really important for your listeners to understand that, you know, there's a market for black suffering, right, in this city and in this country. And it's
market for black suffering.
It's a racket.
It's been monetized.
Right. Right. And so there's competition. I mean, there's real competition, because if a lot of these institutions were to really provide the infrastructure and resources for community to be able to be self-sufficient.
So that's it. So what are they not doing then? What should they be doing that they're not doing?
Well, so if you think about, like, any of the monies that any of us have received, to drop in the bucket compared to some of the major institutions mm-hmm. that are tasked with addressing some of these problems, right? So when you think about, for, and I'll call names, you think about something, you know, for instance, like the Family League of Baltimore, right? It's a major philanthropic entity in this town. It's the designated local management board. For years, for the past 20 years or so, it's been designated with the responsibility of helping to coordinate the strategy around families and community in Baltimore City. But it's an entity that has the kind of traditional human social service paradigm that sees folks in community as just helpless, that need folks to come in to our community and save us, right? And that's, again, not speaking to the intentions of the folks that are part of that institution, but it speaks to the paradigm from which they come from in terms of delivery of services, which then affects the organizations they'll fund, to what extent they'll fund them, right? And, you know, the kind of social capital that they're able to designate on certain organizations above others. And so what happens is a lot of us, many of us, individually may get credibility to the extent that we're connected to an entity that'll lift us up as individuals, mm-hmm. right? Mm. But that doesn't translate to the broader community and ecosystem of folks and communities that have been doing work for a very long time, right? And so that's, so when I said yes and no in the beginning, it's really important that we're clear that even though some of us have been able to get, myself included, have been able to get this platform, it's really undermined this, that in certain ways, it undermines the understanding that there is a broader array of folks in our communities besides us. To your specific question about the war on drugs and Trump administration, twofold. The first is that you're right. I think the Trump administration is capitulating to their base, right? I think it's really important, though, for folks to keep in mind that much of the criminal justice, many of the laws that govern criminal justice are state and local. So it's going to be very important that we pay attention to state and local law around this. And even though we've seen an acknowledgement on the state and local level of the problem with mass incarceration and the issue of seeing it as a public health issue, again, that same profiteering that I mentioned has undermined the effectiveness of programs taking the approach that Elder Harris is talking about. Mm-hmm. So instead of empowering community to be in the lead of changing the paradigm in the way that we deal with criminal justice and this issue as a public health issue, you have people who are professionals connected to major institutions in charge of efforts that, quite frankly, they're not qualified to fix because their training is primarily in academic institutions that aren't connected to community-based approaches or community-based organizations actually doing the work.
Let's try sneaking one phone call before we go to a break. Maggie in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Ray Kelly, Davon Love, and Elder Harris.
Thank you so much for taking my call. The gentleman who was just speaking, and I didn't get his name,
that's Davon Love.
Spoke, Mr. Love, thank you. You spoke exactly to what I called about. There needs to be an infrastructure and an overall plan for the community. You can't do it piecemeal. There's something called 20-minute neighborhoods or walkable communities where jobs and people are kept in the community. That means money. A 20-minute neighborhood is something, a place where you can walk to everything you need within 1 mile. And because you have Mondawmin so close by, a fixed route bus would be one of the solutions. But by keeping stores and getting people out on the street walking, you develop a real neighborhood where people actually care about each other.
Well, Maggie, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. We do need to take a break, and we will be back with more on this very timely topic. Ray Kelly is here. He's the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition. They're a resident-led advocacy organization in West Baltimore. Davon Love is the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a grassroots think tank that focuses on the public policy interests of Black people in Baltimore. Elder C.W. Harris is the pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church and the founder of Intersection of Change, a community-based nonprofit focused on community development in West Baltimore. Before we take that break, on Mondays, it's our practice here on Midday to read the names of the people who have fallen victim to violence in our city during the previous week. We do so in sympathy and solidarity with their families and friends. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has been compiling a list of Baltimore homicide victims for the past 15 years. And we also consult the Baltimore Sun's list, which they've been keeping since 2007. We send our sympathies to the family of Daryl Smith. He was shot in 2007. He died in February, and last week, the medical examiner ruled his death a homicide. He was 33 years old. So far this year, 109 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. 5 people were victims of homicide in the city last week. They are Gregory Jones, age 38, Michael Scott, age 33, McKinley Williams, age 53, Ronald Rice, age 29, and Andrew Terrell. He was 41 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're spending the day today, as we have on a few other occasions last week and again this week, reflecting on what's happened in our city since the violence and uprising that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray in April of 2015. The two-year anniversary of the uprising, as it's come to be known, was last Thursday. Joining me in the studio, three very prominent and very successful activists in our community. Davon Love is the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. That's a think tank that focuses on the public policy interests of African Americans in our city. Ray Kelly is a lifelong Sandtown resident, and he's the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition. That's a resident-led advocacy organization based in West Baltimore. And Elder C.W. Harris is here as well. He's the pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church on Pennsylvania Avenue and the founder of Intersection of Change, an organization focused on community development, again, on the West Side. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday at wipr.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. So, Ray Kelly, the homicide rate in our city is the worst it has ever been, given that we have the same number of murders at this point in the year, you know, end of April, as we did in 1993. But back in 1993, we had about 100,000 more residents who lived in the city. So if you take the rate of number of people killed per 100,000 people, it's even worse than it was 24 years ago. We've got this consent decree, and certainly No Boundaries was very much involved in informing what needed to be in that consent decree. So when it comes to changes that need to take place in the police department, there also need to be some changes in the efficacy, the success rate of police doing more, it seems, to stop crime that's taking place on the streets of our city. Do people in Sandtown, are they feeling any safer than they felt 2 years ago?
So I'll say this. In 2014, Western District, where Sandtown Winchester is located, had the lowest homicide rate in 12 years. So it was through collaboration, community visibility, constant community engagement on multiple levels, and we just created a paradigm of we're here, and of course we know that activity doesn't want to be seen and witnessed. So that worked for us. Following the unrest, we kind of had this escalation. It wasn't a spike because it's still escalating, but there was multiple facets involved. There was a definite pullback from policing in our communities. We kind of voiced multiple times throughout the progress of the investigation and what was actually happening in our community with this influx of activity and a lack of policing that kind of created or violence that was engulfing our communities. And that wasn't what was addressed. And we kind of continued to deal with it during the process of a consent decree investigation, the negotiations, and the actual signing. So I feel like now we have the opportunity to actually create the framework on how we address the crime issues and the street issues together with the police, so it is done in a constitutional and equitable type manner. So really, for past 2 years, we've been under-policed in our communities because of the contention, the trials, everything that was going on. So there isn't a feeling of safety in our communities. We have to kind of elevate people like Erica Alston, who's taken the ultimate pragmatic approach, the safest place for kids in our environment right now is inside. So now we have the opportunity to address this crime issue together without the contention.
Mm-hmm. And Davon Love, I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, how does one find the sweet spot between too much policing, not enough policing? Obviously, you can't have unconstitutional policing, and the Department of Justice certainly identified, flagrant violations in that regard. But the culture of the police department has to change, but also a culture of gang culture, a culture of violence around drugs and territory and that kind of thing also has to change. Where does that sweet spot
derive? I want to lift up, something, the first part that Ray just mentioned when he talked about, in Sandtown, when they had the kind of best outcomes in terms of safety, there was strong collaboration, a variety of different ways. And I think, one of the things that we have to get ourselves to conceptually is that law enforcement is not the agency that will make our community safer, right? And in many ways, they should be the last resort. Right. And a part of the issue is that when we think about public safety, we always talk about and put front and center the police department. And I think Ray is way more effective at addressing violence in the community than the police are, right? And I think we need to start thinking about different ways of resourcing people in community whose responsibility is public safety. Because if you think about, at least the way I understand it, y'all can correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of the violence, the shootings that we see in our community are usually escalations from things that aren't that big of a deal, right? And that if there were early interventions, more folks available to folks who engage in that activity, that you could prevent a lot of it, right? And just given the culture of our communities, police officers are only going to be able to get but so far, right? So now it's important for them to collaborate, because I think there are ways in which the police department can undermine what community does. There are ways to alienate police in a way that isn't helpful to the efforts in community. So in terms of that sweet spot you're talking about, even the way that the budget is set up for public safety, right? A third of it goes to the police department, most of any agency in the city. And if you look at what constitutes public safety, you're talking primarily about police officers. I think we just need to begin to reimagine public safety in a way where particularly brothers and sisters that are of and from the community, the parts of the community where this happens. I remember after the uprising, there were a group of brothers that came down to our office who were, formerly members of street organizations. And one of the things they said, it was like, look, we know the brothers is out here doing the stuff that's leading all this violence. They were like, but I got to pay my bills. Like, I got stuff I got to take care of, And all I could think of was, how much better would this city be if those brothers who decided we want to be a part of the solution would be able to be paid, to have a living, to go out and make our community safer?
Because we have the Safe Streets program where, formerly incarcerated folks are out on the street being, interrupters, violence interrupters. They're trying to get involved in these disputes before they escalate to a point of violence. But Elder Harris, you've lived in Sandtown for, as you said, 67 years. I'm just quoting you, sir. I'm just quoting you.
I'm proud of it.
And you remember a time.
I remember.
When it was a lot nicer to walk around the streets of Sandtown Winchester.
We have 40,000 people in the Sandtown Winchester community. That's 72 square blocks. I can name the stores. We could go to any shoe store we want. Shane's, Danny's. All of these shoe stores were in Sandtown. We could go to get our clothes cleaned and pressed at Young's Cleaners. We did not have to leave our community at all to get anything that we wanted. Now, I remember that. Now, integration had a lot to do with it because we were hemmed up because of racism in its broadest sense. And folks just didn't care. So we would get told right on. But we had these black-owned stores. We just stayed within our communities. We didn't own cars. Now, we couldn't afford it, but we didn't have to go right down. And look, when we didn't have money, right, put our name on a little white book, gave it to them. They gave us the food. No one was hungry. No one was hungry. We trusted one another. We were community in its purest sense. So I saw that.
So is the answer then, again, as Davon has written and talked about for years, we've talked about this on this show, and you and I have talked about the importance of black institutions, the importance of institutions springing up from the community.
I mean, yes.
When I take a look, and I'm no expert on development, but when I just think about the folks I've talked to about Port Covington or the development that's happened in town, if I just look at the last 10 years. Where are the neighborhoods that have come up? Hamden is all of a sudden this very hip, hipster Brooklyn, south. We've got Remington, this beautiful R house and a great apartment building over there and all this kind of stuff. You've got, obviously, Harbor East, Canton and stuff, and then we're looking at Port Covington. They're white neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
The money is going to white neighborhoods.
Right. And if you look at the tax incentives that are used to find it, because that's the important piece. See, a lot of people say, well, if you have the money, you can develop those areas and those areas have the money. But there's public subsidies that go to creating those communities to the extent they are. I grew up in.
But it's chicken and egg, too, because what developer is going to say, well, sure, I'll do a $5 million apartment building in, at Pennsylvania and Pressman. I mean, it's just too big of financial risk. I mean, that's what they would say. Right.
Right. And a part of it is seeing the strengths in our community and being able to understand that development isn't just buildings and skyscrapers, but it's about the ability to invest in the human capital in the community to be able to actualize the kinds of opportunities that it's missing. There's a lot of talent in our communities. I grew up in Howard Park, and the neighborhood I grew up in, adjacent to the Forest Park golf course and just all this beautiful stuff around it. And I was with a friend of mine yesterday and said, you know what? The fact that this community is in the condition that it's in is a testament to the existence of racism. Mm-hmm. Right. This could be like a black Charles Village. Right. If it was given the proper investment, because you have folks with money in that community, but just the willingness to invest publicly in those community based black institutions that will provide the stability necessary. And again, that goes to the folks in high level positions making decisions about where those public subsidies go.
Well, I'm pushing them to put their money where their mouth is. Right. I have two feasibility studies. One's completed and one's on its way. Both of them are multi-$1 million operation. One is an aquaponic, and right next to us, right there on Pressman Street, is a 4-story complex which will serve the community. This is beginning one building at a time. I'm pushing them, put their money where their mouth is. And I'm big enough to do it, too.
Yes, sir. I don't think anybody would question that particular admonition. Well, I do appreciate all of you guys coming by. It's always good to see you and to keep tabs of the incredibly important work that you're doing. It's a complicated and long-standing set of issues that we're thinking about. So it's an arbitrary thing to be talking about it 2 years after April 2015, but we will, of course, continue to talk about it on this program and elsewhere. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Elder C.W. Harris, he's the pastor of the Newborn Community of Faith Church in West Baltimore and the founder of Intersection of Change. Davon Love is the director of public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Ray Kelly is the co-director of the No Boundaries Coalition. We'll have more information about all three of these gentlemen and the work that they're doing at WYPR.org/midday. Coming up on the program tomorrow, Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland and the author and Salon columnist Dee Watkins. They'll join me for the Midday Culture Connection, and I hope you can join us as well. I'd like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. They can be found on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tom Hall on behalf of all of us on the Midday team. Have a great day.